Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Lauren Woodman, Microsoft General Manager, Education Programs, and Lauren is a top global technology policy authority. Lauren, thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Lauren, you've got this amazing background. You've done a lot. Your career spans many sort of domains. Now, can you profile your top three wins prior to joining Microsoft and the lessons you wish to share?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Stephen. I've had a very varied career before I joined Microsoft, and certainly those experiences have taught me quite a bit. So let me see if I can't pick out a couple of my favorites from my background. One, I think, was some of the work that I did on privacy policy in the late 1990s. This was really an emerging policy area for a lot of us in the United States as e-commerce and the internet became ubiquitous for individuals and businesses around the world. And as we in the United States were really moving to an online marketplace, these questions of privacy that frankly many other governments had dealt with around the world were really becoming front and center in the technology policy world. And it was something that a lot of folks hadn't dealt with and certainly didn't have the depth of expertise that policy professionals, elsewhere in the world had. We did quite a bit of work around figuring out how the United States and especially the EU could cooperate under the safe harbor that went into effect in the late 1990s and the right around the turn of the century. I loved that experience for a couple of reasons, and it certainly taught me a couple of things that I've carried with me moving forward. The first was it required us in the United States to really sit down and understand what the policy priorities were from a European perspective, and to have a conversation around what Europeans were expecting and what the EU was expecting, as well as what we in the United States valued and felt we needed to keep really front and center as we thought about privacy issues. And the second thing I learned from that was how to think about not just the policy parameters for today, but to think about how technology moving forward might affect the discussions and the decisions that we were coming to. Of course, technology changes quickly. Certainly in that time period, technology was changing very quickly, and the consumer experience especially was changing very quickly. So we needed to keep that in mind. That was a real challenge, frankly, because always projecting out what will happen with technology is sometimes sometimes we're right and sometimes we're not quite 100% right. So we had to really think about what might be possible and what policy parameters were needed to be in place in order to protect the appropriate and safe development of the consumer experience online. The second thing I think was really interesting before joining Microsoft was much earlier in my career and working in a startup environment. And I worked with a small company here in Washington, D.C. that was really focused on using technology to help companies solve some of their internal business process challenges. That was, a very hot topic at the time. It's still, certainly we all still talk about the efficiencies that technology can provide to businesses. The thing that really taught me was the idea of just frankly jumping in with both feet to make something that you wanted to be successful. And it was really, really important as we've seen, or certainly as I've seen, throughout my career, when you become really passionate about making something come alive and be successful, that willingness just to throw everything into it is really key. I don't think sometimes when you're trying to do something new or trying to do something that's really difficult or trying to change the trajectory of a path of a business that you can do it without throwing yourself into it completely. And that experience certainly taught me that. And the last thing I would say is, early in my career, I was an intern on Capitol Hill, like so many other people have done throughout their careers. And it was a really wonderful experience, simply because it taught me how to go into a workplace that frankly I knew very little about from an experiential perspective, and to be open to the learning that I needed to have in order to make the most of that experience. I think, quite often, especially as we get further on in our careers, it's very easy for us to say, oh, I've done something like this before. I've even done something exactly like this before, and to bring with us the experiences of our past. That's certainly important. But as the world around us changes, and it is constantly changing, being open to new ideas, keeping your eyes open, and learning from the folks around you, I think is really critically important for continued success.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned this sort of work as an intern on Capitol Hill, and how would you sort of contrast your experiences then to what you see in Washington today?
Well, it's certainly a very different world, mostly because it was, 25 years ago. And I think I don't spend a lot of time on Capitol Hill these days, so I'm not sure that I'm the best person to answer, the question in terms of what it's like, from an insider's perspective. I think the thing that was really interesting and frankly inspiring to me, and one of the reasons I stayed in the policy world after my experience as an intern, was because there really were a number of people that I had the privilege to work with, some of whom, frankly, are still around today, and new faces that I'm sure share this perspective, who took to heart, the idea of representative government, and really wanted to come to Washington to represent the folks that they represented back in their home states and in their home districts, and to reach across the aisle, reach across perceived differences, and have those open conversations in order to find a solution that was great. I think that's very difficult these days. I mean, I think we've all seen and understand the difficulties that sometimes plague Washington these days. But I remain convinced and remain optimistic that there are folks out there with the right focus in terms of what they're trying to do and the leadership capacity in order to make to affect some meaningful change.
Lauren, it's interesting. You talk about sort of reaching out and perhaps being inclusive and getting sort of the feedback from the broader community rather than sort of taking a niche approach and so on. And I can sort of see that with Microsoft Education, which are the general managers. So what is the mandate behind Microsoft Education for 2013 and 2014?
It's a great question, and I think it's certainly one of the things that we keep in mind here at Microsoft when we think about the work that we do in education. At the end of the day, Microsoft is a software company, and we're really focused on the technology behind the software and the devices and the services that we provide. But in order to make that effective in education, it's really incumbent upon us to work with education professionals and education experts to make sure that the use of technology in schools is done effectively and keeps the desired outcomes around an improved environment for teaching and learning at the forefront. At the end of the day, our goal is to make sure that learning can happen anywhere and at any time, and certainly technology makes that possible. So all of the work that we do is really focused on how do we use technology effectively inside the classroom with a focus on student outcomes, and how do we work with professionals around the world who can bring their domain expertise to Microsoft and work in partnership with us so that we can bring our expertise around the technology side so that we can improve what's happening in schools around the world.
How would you contrast what you're seeing then in the different sort of regions around the world versus, let's say, what's happening in the U.S.? And I know that you've enabled and empowered something like 11 million teachers and something like, 230, 40 million students. So what does it all mean region by region?
It's a great question, and it's one I get asked, all the time, frankly, and how does one region compare to another or one project compare with another? And it's sometimes difficult to draw comparisons because the local situations are sometimes very different. But I'd say a couple of things, based on my experience. And you're right, we've had the privilege of working in many, many countries around the world. One of our key programs, Partners in Learning, currently runs in about 119 countries and has been for about 10 years. So we've got a depth of experience that we've really been privileged to learn from and have those experiences. There's a couple of things that I would say. One, we see in a lot of the emerging markets a real energy around bringing technology into the classroom at a very thoughtful level. And what I mean by that is that for many years, we've talked about technology in the classroom and technology in education. And for many years, we've simply airdropped technology into education without really thinking about how we land these tools effectively with educators and with students so that we can improve the learning experience. What we see in a lot of emerging economies where perhaps they haven't had that same experience of this technology being or increasingly ubiquitous, and so they've got the opportunity to leapfrog where many of the developed countries are today. And I'm not a big fan of the phrase leapfrog, but you know, when you don't have technology already in the school, thinking about how to land it today creates new opportunities that sometimes the more developed economies or schools that have already started to use technology quite broadly already have. And so we see these economies thinking about how they bring one-to-one computing into their classrooms, thinking very deeply about the teacher experience and how we provide the right professional development for educators to understand how to use technology effectively, really thinking about school leadership and what each school wants to accomplish by the use of technology in their classrooms, and then taking the final step around thinking about how does this change the student learning experience? You know, what things need to be done around changing the way that not only teachers teach, but that students do their homework, or that their learning activities inside the classroom can be changed, and how they extend that learning beyond the classroom. And so it's really inspiring to see some of this work happening, you know, all around the world and in lots of different places. And while, you know, I point that out as somewhat of a difference between emerging economies and developed economies, that's not always true. I mean, Portugal's a very developed economy, but several years ago they did this and provided a one-to-one computing experience for all the students in their country, thinking very deeply about all of these pieces, even though, you know, they already had some experience with the use of technology, and they've done very, very well with it.
So what would be then your success metrics as general manager?
Well, we look at a couple of different things around how we define success. And some of them we look at in terms of whether or not the assets that we're creating for use with these technology deployments are being well used. You know, I mean, I think teachers and school leaders and education policymakers are very good at judging the quality of the resources that we provide. So one of the things that we look at is, are the folks with whom we are working telling us that the professional development and the classroom activities and the tutorials and all of the types of things that the Partners in Learning program provides, are they really helping teachers use technology effectively? I mean, that's you can get a pretty good sense very quickly as to whether or not the professional development that we're providing is actually resonating with the teachers and the school leaders that we're working with. And so we certainly, you know, talk and research and measure that feedback from those folks to make sure that we're moving in the right direction. The second thing that we look at is whether or not teaching practice is evolving to use technology more effectively. And this is somewhat of an ongoing conversation because, you know, certainly as technology evolves, teaching practice evolves, teaching practice and what great teaching practice with technology looks like is an evolving conversation. We've done lots of research over the years around what types of teaching practices and how technology is used and what the connection there is to student learning outcomes. And certainly we see, you know, obviously a strong connection, and we feel very strongly that there is a connection between the great use of technology in the classroom and students being more engaged with their learning and feeling better about what they're learning and improving their outcomes. And we're starting to see, you know, those metrics really take off. But we also know that as technology changes, how we define innovative teaching is also going to change. And so we do a lot of work in terms of whether or not we are preparing the next generation of teachers and in-service teachers to use the new tools that are coming down the road. And of course, you know, I mean, Microsoft is a large global company, and we certainly look at reach and impact just through straight numbers and in terms of adoption as one of our key metrics.
You know, this brings to mind a series of questions, but maybe I'll sort of make it maybe more example focused. You know, for example, you've talked about sort of how technology use in school is good for students and educators, and you talked about sort of tie-ins to learning outcomes. Do you have some real examples that you can give of why and how technology is being used and it's good for students and educators, and which educators are using it, or is it just one segment, or should be all of them? And are there examples of technology driving improved learning outcomes, like case studies that you can give out?
Sure. So let me break that question down into a couple of answers, because there was a lot in that. Around which teachers do we see using technology? You know, interestingly, it's when I first started this work, and when we first started this work, and when I first introduced some of the work that we do to folks, you know, outside of Microsoft and outside of education, there's an immediate assumption that, frankly, it's our younger teachers in more developed economies that are the most rapid adopters of technology inside the classroom. And certainly our experience over the last 10 years has been that that's not necessarily true. We do a number of teacher recognition events all around the world and work with literally millions of teachers every year. And the age range, the experience range, the familiarity with technology range is quite vast. We've had teachers that are, right out of their teacher training programs, you know, and are very early in their career. And we've had teachers that are frankly later in their career and have been in the classroom for decades, that have been, you know, shining examples of the effective use of technology in the classroom. And so when we talk to policymakers about the adoption of technology and the transition that many teachers are going through in terms of learning how to use those tools, you know, we are very quick to point out that any teacher who is in the classroom and frankly can already do the difficult work of teaching can certainly learn easily to adopt technology tools to their teaching practice and leverage these assets in a way that will help their students. So, you know, we certainly see teachers of at all stages in their career all across the world in all types of economies using technology effectively. There are some great examples, and we've had the privilege over the last several years to do a number of teacher recognition events around the world that recognize teachers that have done really amazing things on a classroom by classroom and a project by project level. We run something every year known as the Partners in Learning Global Forum, which pulls together about 150 teachers that have been selected from a successively competitive process. You know, they start at the local level and then they compete at the national level and then at the regional level. And those that have made it through come to the Global Forum to have their individual projects recognized as the best in the world. And through that process each year, we highlight about 18 or 20 teachers from around the world that really are the best of the best. Some of my favorite examples. We had a teacher, I guess last year, through that process that was using Link, which is our online communication platform, to teach visually impaired students mathematics at a distance. And this was a teacher who had a specialization in special education. She happened to be from Washington State. But students that have visual impairments sometimes have a real difficulty in seeing the whiteboard or the chalkboard at some distance. And in mathematics, while, you know, teachers are showing kids how to work out formulas or in this geometry, or the slope of a line, that's difficult sometimes to see at a distance. Or if you have difficulty in seeing contrast, it's certainly difficult to see, from sitting in the back of the classroom. But by using Link and some of the accessibility tools that are available online, she can actually bring to a student who's visually impaired that whiteboard at a very up close and personal level. So a student can adjust their screen and watch exactly what she's doing on a virtual whiteboard to see how that formula gets worked out. And as a result, the students that were falling behind in math or who frankly had decided that careers that required math wouldn't be possible for them because of the learning experience are doing very, very well in math, and some are making some really interesting career choices, because they now have greater confidence in their mathematic ability because they simply had the opportunity to learn it. Another great example that we had from a couple of years ago, we had a teacher who was teaching the Count of Monte Cristo in a literature class, and rather than doing what at least would have been my experience in an English literature class, which was to read the book and write the book report. She actually had her students reenact the trial, and do that, so that to demonstrate their learning, of the concepts of the Count of Monte Cristo. And they used all sorts of different technology tools to build the evidence and the storyline, and their case. It was a really, really, multifaceted student project. And realistically, was one of those great examples of taking, a pretty generic experience. I mean, we've all read books and had to write book reports, in the past, but using some technology tools in a way that they weren't the focus of what she was doing, but they were very much in service to the students who needed to learn not only the book itself, but the concepts behind the book, as well as the 21st century skills that we want all of our kids to graduate schools with. Collaboration, critical thinking, great planning skills, the ability to work in groups and communicate an idea. All of those things got wrapped up into the project that she did simply because of the way that it was presented. Now, the other question you asked is, are we seeing any impact on student learning outcomes? And we are starting to see that in a lot of different places. And I would point out one that I think is particularly interesting. It's a school in Australia, Varsity College in Queensland. Varsity College started a one-to-one computing program several years ago, back in the 2007-2008 timeframe, and they looked very carefully at what the right technology was for the right age group for the students. And that was really a critical piece, because not all technology is appropriate for all types of learning activities. And so they were very thoughtful about what type of learning was happening with different age groups and what types of tools were necessary to impact those students' learning. The other thing that they did that was really, really important is they put in place a very rigorous, very well thought out, very comprehensive set of teacher professional development goals that accompanied the deployment of one-to-one, so that teachers really knew how to use the tools that were deployed effectively. And what they did was, for younger students, for the kindergarten through about third grade students, they have a slate. It's a slate device. It's primarily designed for consumption, like most slate devices. For kids that are learning to read, practicing their letters, learning basic math, really some basic concepts that will be the foundation of their future schooling, a slate is a great device. For the children in the middle years, they use the school-issued laptop. I mean, laptop like all of us are familiar with, a keyboard and screen, along with wireless access, because kids at that learning stage, are really getting into more complex subjects. They're learning to write a lot and those types of things, and a laptop was appropriate. And as kids moved into high school and into the upper years, they actually have a full-fledged tablet, so that it has touch, it has stylus input, it has keyboard input, and really supports the very multifaceted learning that kids are doing at those stages. And so when kids want to share notes and they happen to use OneNote, they can do that not only by writing notes with their stylus, but also typing formal things or capturing things from the web and embedding video and voice and all of those types of things that create such a rich learning environment for the complex subjects that those kids are tackling. Now, Varsity is not it's not a particularly unusual school in the sense that its demographics are very varied, and certainly the school was, it's obviously got some very effective leadership. The school was doing okay before they did one-to-one, but now what they see consistently is that their students are outperforming national averages on all of the national test scores across the board. And what's particularly more remarkable about that is that students in Queensland are actually tested a little bit younger than students across the rest of Australia. So not only are their students performing more consistently at higher levels than students across the rest of Australia, they're doing it at a younger age.
Well, Lauren, I had the privilege of sitting in the session with yourself in the Commonwealth of Learning and UNESCO at the UNESCO WISIS Plus 10 review in Paris in February, and I seem to recall something like Cornwallis Academy having something like a 90% higher performance achievements versus 60% in the past by making use of this Partners in Learning program. Am I wrong, or was that another group?
No, you're very good at remembering the details. That's great. that we have certainly seen success out of Cornwallis in the UK. I would love to claim credit, for all of the work that they've done. I think it's actually been a very good partnership in terms of our work with them and the work that they've done. And certainly, I think, again, it's another great example of the school leadership and the school faculty working together to think about what type of professional development do they need in order to use technology effectively, and what kind of data do they need about student performance. One of the things that's particularly interesting about the work that Cornwallis has done has been they've got great insights in terms of the way that their students perform, and so they've really they're a great example of using student data in order to identify children that are either doing exceptionally well or need some additional support as they move through their education experience. And you're absolutely right. They've moved from about 60% of their students achieving five or more grades, you know, A through C grades, to more than 90% of their students doing so over the last couple of years since they've taken these steps to change their teaching practice and the way that they look at their students. I think that's another area that's, you know, of particular interest to educators, and it certainly speaks to the education experience. I mean, we all know that, you know, education is an accretive process. You know, you learn one concept and then you build on that throughout the course of your career. And as you go through school, you know, math gets harder, the literature gets harder, the science gets harder, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the problem is that if we miss kids, or one of the risks is if we miss kids or kids don't fully understand a concept at some point in time, they risk falling further behind as they continue to go through school because they haven't learned the underlying principles. And the use of data allows us to get greater insight to student performance and to see whether or not all of our kids in a class or all of our students in a school have mastered the concepts that they need in order to move forward, and then be able to remediate quickly if students are falling behind or didn't seem to grasp a particular concept, so that problem doesn't get exponentially worse as they continue to go through school, but in fact we can make sure that they come up to speed very quickly. And that's one of the ways that Cornwallis has done such an amazing job over the last couple of years, is by using data to make sure that all students are progressing.
So my next question is about sort of the resources that Microsoft is providing in the classroom. And you talked about the link communications technology, which was a great case study, great example. I'm sure there's things like SharePoint or Office 365 or some of the online resources, cloud resources that Microsoft has provided, maybe Xbox and more, which can be used in the classroom. Do you have some examples there?
Sure. I mean, and certainly this is one of the things I think that we're, you know, most excited and most passionate about. And it really gets to the, you know, really the core products that Microsoft has always been so proud of, and thinking about how they can be most effectively used in the classroom. And certainly as we see the move to the cloud, this really gets very, very exciting. Certainly, you know, I think the experience that we have with Windows 8 has been a really positive one. We think about providing students a very rich computing environment, right? I mean, Windows 8 supports touch, it supports stylus. It, of course, works very well with the keyboard. The interface is fast and fluid. And for students that have grown up with technology, it's a very natural way to get information with all of that data surfaced for you in live tiles across the entire interface. The other, you know, sort of new aspect to our Office computing suite is the development of Office 365. And Office 365 allows schools to provide their students a very rich cloud-enabled productivity suite, so that not only are they, you know, learning with their subject matter expertise, but they're also learning the tools that they're going to need, quite frankly, when they move into further study or when they move into the workplace. The collaborative features that are built into Office 365, whether it's through SharePoint or through Link, are really critical, not only to helping students in their learning activities, but preparing them for the workplace. I mean, we all know that we collaborate with peers on a day-to-day basis in the work that we do, and helping students learn, perfect, and gain those skills throughout their educational experiences is really critical, not only to helping them learn more, but to preparing them effectively. One of the things, though, I think that is perhaps most interesting, and frankly, it's one of the things that's often overlooked, that's most relevant in the education space, is a tool called OneNote. And OneNote is part of the Office Productivity Suite, and it's a really wonderful way for students to be able to organize their notes by class, to embed video and audio, and to handwrite notes. I mean, you can think of it as a virtual notebook, but that's really, frankly, selling it a bit short in terms of what OneNote provides. The neat thing about OneNote is not just its organizing capability, which is such a critical skill for kids to learn, but also the collaboration and the joint learning that it enables across the classroom. So you can share OneNote notebooks. So if I take some notes in one class, and I want to share them with you, Stephen, so that you can see what my perspective was on a particular lecture or the way that I tried to solve a math problem. I can share that with you. I can do it in real time, and we can actually work on something together. And in very sophisticated, and it's actually not all that sophisticated, but in very smart deployments of OneNote, we actually see teachers creating OneNote notebooks for their entire class. So my teacher notebook would have not only my lesson plans and my learning activities, but it would also include tabs for each one of my students so that I can actually provide all of my learning activities and homework and tests and quizzes and student communication inside that OneNote environment. And I can see not only the results of my students' work, but I can see how they're working together, which helps me improve my teaching as well, because I can see what they took notes on. I can see what what they wrote down and whether or not they had questions about it based on the notes that they're taking in class. And OneNote is just a really, really amazing tool in order to be able to help kids organize, share, and work with their teachers, in whatever subject, frankly, that it is that they're studying. The other thing we see, of course, is, as we look at some of the more consumer-oriented platforms that are coming out of Microsoft, the Xbox and Kinect, those are really interesting things to think about bringing into the classroom. And Kinect in particular is something that we're looking at very, very closely. We've already seen a number of educators around the world start to use Kinect in very interesting ways. Certainly, I think there are some applications in fairly straightforward ways. I mean, we certainly see people using Kinect, to help with physical activity classes or physical education classes and those types of things. I have two young children, and I'm pretty sure that my teachers on a rainy Seattle day, would love to have a Kinect in their classroom and to work off some of the kids' energy. But they're way more interesting applications when you start to think about more sophisticated use of Kinect. And I'll give you one example. We were working with a researcher and professor at the University of Washington who is using Kinect to teach kids math. And she's doing it at lots of different grade levels and in lots of different math disciplines. But one of the things that was most interesting to me was looking at how she was teaching fourth and fifth graders the math behind percentages and ratios and fractions by using one of the dancing games, right? And so you can imagine the dancing games, and you take so many steps to the left and so many steps to the right and so many steps forward and how many turns and those types of things. But if you start to think about that and you then ask the question and say, okay, in your 30 minutes of dancing, how many steps did you take to the right and what percentage of that were the steps to the right of the total? That becomes very real for a student, that there's a real connection to the data. And certainly one of the things that's sometimes challenging for students in math is to think about, how am I ever going to use this in my real life? And if you can provide a connection to the data, it becomes very, very interesting. So that's one example. The other thing that has happened with Kinect that's been really interesting is there's another professor at the University of Washington who has done some work with Kinect and teaching kids how to calculate the slope of a line, which I love this example because it was one of the things I struggled with most, frankly, in my math classes growing up. And it's very interesting to watch a child stand in front of a Kinect and using his arm change the slope of a line and see the corresponding changes in the equation. And that really starts to bring home some very difficult concepts. And you can work it the other way, which is, if this is the equation of the line, which way do you need to position your arms in order to represent that slope? And that becomes a very interesting, give and take for students to use when they're learning some of these concepts. Those are just a couple of examples. There are literally thousands more ways, probably millions more ways, that our products get used effectively in the classroom. We actually surface all of those on the Partners in Learning Network, which is a resource that we provide to teachers around the world, not only for teacher-generated content and great things that teachers themselves are doing in their classrooms, but these examples that we find or that our labs have developed. We put all of those up on the network so the teachers around the world can make the most of them.
Lauren, it's really interesting. You bring up this whole resource called Partners in Learning, and I believe you indicated, again, sitting in on UNESCO session in February, I believe you said it was a $500 million investment. It's grown to $750 million. What regions are represented in terms of languages? In other words, is it just pure English, or are there other languages now within that platform?
That's a great question, and certainly one of the things when we launched Partners in Learning back in 2003, and you're right, we initially launched it with a $250 million investment. We renewed that commitment in 2008 for another $250 million, and we've just renewed the commitment again for another $250 million. So bringing our total commitment to Partners in Learning to $750 million over the course of what will end up being 15 years. That one of the things that we wanted to do with Partners in Learning is, frankly, not make it a U.S.-centric or English-only experience. And Partners in Learning now runs in 119 countries. There are resources available in literally dozens of languages. On the network itself, on the Partners in Learning network, which is available to any teacher for free anywhere in the world, we use machine translation to support about 36 languages simultaneously. Now, machine translation isn't perfect. There's certainly some limitations with it. And it's one of those things where, the more folks use it and the more they help us improve it, not only on the network, but all across the web, the experience gets better. And certainly some of our languages are better than others. But the thing that's nice about it is that it immediately opens the door to cross-country collaboration for teachers anywhere in the world. So I can upload a learning activity in English, but teachers anywhere in the world can then download that and use it and comment on it and see it in their native language. We have developed professional development curricula in dozens of languages. One of our big efforts right now is around something called Teaching with Technology. Teaching with Technology is some curriculum that we developed to help teachers meet the UNESCO ICT competency framework for teachers. So UNESCO did some work around what should be the core competencies for teachers anywhere in terms of their use of ICT in the classroom. That's a great international standard for educators to look at and aspire to. Many countries have adopted their own versions of that, and the Teaching with Technology helps teachers understand not only the standards themselves, but also to make sure that their competencies meet those standards. That curriculum is currently available in English and in Russian. We will have Spanish, French, and Arabic over the course of the next couple of months, and we'll continue to build out more and more languages around the world.
So all of those links then are available in your Partners in Learning website?
That's correct.
Now, you just talked about this UNESCO competency learning framework that they developed, and I guess this then ties in with where I first saw you at the UNESCO Paris Summit in February. I really enjoyed that session. I thought it kind of tied all the pieces together. What did you see as the key outcomes from that summit?
I thought it was a very, very good conversation, and there were so many interesting things that came out of it. I think it's hard to pick three simply because I think there's so many different constituencies. I mean, certainly I think, as a technology company, we were thrilled to see the emphasis on ensuring that, broadband access was, continued to be a focus for governments around the world. We were very happy to see the continued emphasis on education and that every child deserves a right to a quality education. We just believe that to be absolutely fundamental for the work that UNESCO continues to do. We were very happy to see the continued work on language diversity. We actually have done a tremendous amount of work around language diversity and how do we make sure that computing platforms are available in a wide variety of languages. And so I was very happy to see that there were good conversations that happened at UNESCO around continuing to both drive awareness and to encourage the development of local language content on the web and on computing platforms around the world. So I thought those were really critical. I think from a broader policy perspective, taking it out of the Microsoft realm and taking a step back and looking at what the UNESCO Charter has been, and certainly what the Charter has been for the World Summit on Information Society since it started almost a decade ago, or I guess a decade ago now. I think the continued emphasis on the cultural aspects of what needs to happen in the information society are really critical. And certainly I think as the information society continues to grow And as more and more of our lives become deeply intertwined with the digital side of our lives and the barriers between, you know, our day-to-day sort of tangible life and the work that we do online increasingly become interconnected, we need to have rich conversations and very open conversations around how we make sure that we are bringing into and protecting the cultural aspects that all of us hold dear, you know, in our own countries, but we're also doing that online. And so I was very happy to see, you know, that conversation continue and certainly expect that as we, you know, as computing becomes more and more ubiquitous for every region of the world, that that will be a conversation that will not only be necessary, but will continue to be critically important to making sure that we make the most of the technology that's available to us.
You know, it's interesting. Probably some additional comments. Your session had such a profound impact on me was that I sort of got this feeling that there were so few changes in the last 300 years from a typical 18th century classroom to a classroom in June 2013 and that many are still very instructor-centric. Or I think in your presentation you talked about 95% of students, you know, preschool or age 5 love school, but this drops to something like 37% by age 14. Or again, I think in your presentation you talked about 30% of teachers. In fact, I think over 30% of teachers wanted to quit teaching in 2 years, or the CEO of Commonwealth of Learning talked about McKinsey, something where 40% of employers have difficulty filling entry-level jobs and student skills do not match the job requirements. And it, you get this feeling that the education system is broken and you do need programs like your Partnership in Learning or the UNESCO ICT competency framework, or this other idea that was brought up, this accessing and teaching 21st century skills. I think it's an initiative that you're partnered with, what, Cisco and Intel?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's correct.
So, I don't know, I think what you're doing is, you know, such amazing work and enabling the world. You speak a lot of forums. Are there other ones you're going to speak on or at later this year? And what do you hope to accomplish from these forums?
I do a fair amount of speaking. I will say that as we move into summer vacation, I'm not actually doing any speaking over the next couple of months, which is kind of nice. But come this fall, I will be back. We will be doing an event in Mexico where I will be, and then again at the Partners in Learning Global Forum, I think is my next big opportunity to talk about the work that we're doing within Partners in Learning. But certainly we actually chronicle not only the work that we do, but that educators around the world do on a site called Daily Adventures. That's Daily Edventures. That is really, I think, one where some of these ideas get brought to the fore literally every day. So every day we highlight someone that's doing something remarkable in education somewhere in the world. Just because there's so many good ideas out there that we could do this every day. And we set out to see whether or not we could find a great idea a day. And it turns out, I think we've got several years worth of ideas ahead of us. You know, I do want to address the point that you made though, because I think it's a really critical one. There is a sense, I think, amongst a lot of folks that the education system is broken and that, you know, it hasn't really evolved to keep up with the demands that the global workforce and the global workplace are putting in front of it, and that our kids are graduating from high school and sometimes even college without the skills or the knowledge that they need in order to be immediately able to find a great job and start to build a career. And certainly we see students having the same level of dissatisfaction. Just last week, we did some work with the Gallup organization here in the United States, and 59% of students said that the skills that they needed when they got their first job, they actually didn't acquire in school, that they didn't feel like school had prepared them for the skills that they needed for the workforce. So I think we're all agreed. You know, certainly Microsoft has a hard time finding qualified applicants for its jobs. We hear that from many of our corporate partners, and students are telling us, you know, when they do land a job, that they don't feel adequately prepared in order to do that. So there's clearly a disconnect in terms of what we need to do. That having been said, I actually remain pretty optimistic about what's getting ready to happen. And I think there's just a number of things that are kind of swirling around all these conversations that are happening around education that gives me a lot of hope about what I expect to be a fairly significant sea change in education over the next 10 to 15 years. And it's a terrible analogy at some level, or a kind of a silly analogy at some point in time. But you know, if you imagine a snow-covered mountain, you know, it looks very stable and it looks very significant until the avalanche starts. You know, and then things go really crazy really quickly. And I kind of feel like that's where we are with education. We have a generation of students that are coming through that not only want to use technology in their classrooms, but frankly expect it. You know, these are kids that have grown up with technology, and the idea that they would come into class and they have to turn off their cell phones and sit down and look forward and write down what someone else says, that's just not their experience in the rest of their lives. And these are kids that are really beginning to demand more from their classrooms. And interestingly, we see many teachers that are coming up either new into the teaching career or who are long-term teachers who are also adopting these technologies and are getting very smart about how to use technology in the classroom and respond to their students' needs more effectively. So I think everybody recognizes that there's a challenge, and we see the problems that are out there, and all of the pieces are kind of starting to line up in order for us to be able to really affect some change. And I think, frankly, once it starts, and once you see, we see it now. We see a handful of school systems really embracing technology and taking on some bold challenges and expecting more, both from their students and from their teachers and from their parents and from the tools that they use. I think what you start to see, you know, a handful more of those, and people say, well, you know what, that I could do that in my school system. That change will be very rapid, and the technology will enable that best practice sharing very quickly, and we will really start to see some change. So I certainly share the concerns, and I certainly share sometimes the frustration that our education system isn't really doing what it needs to be doing right now, but I remain completely optimistic that the educators that are in the workforce, the policymakers that are really thinking deeply about this, and the technology companies that are trying to partner, we're really on the cusp of starting to see some meaningful change.
So you have kind of like a hard stop shortly in a few minutes. I'll just ask one more question. It's a kind of a broad question, and it's about computing. And should computing be recognized a profession on par with like accounting, medicine, and law, with demonstrated professional development, adherence to a code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, and recognized credentials? What are your feelings on that?
Well, I certainly think there's, I think computing as a career is one that is, you know, well recognized as being an attractive career for a variety of reasons. You know, I mean, computing professionals not only get to work in almost any industry, you know, there are very few industries these days where with a degree in computer science or with really great IT skills that you can't find a job. I was having a conversation actually with a student just last week, and he said, well, you know, I really like computers and I really like computer science, but I don't think I want to go write software. And I said, oh, there's so many things that you can do. And he said, well, you know, I really like, you know, I really like agriculture. And I said, just think about, you know, how ubiquitous technology has become in agriculture. He happened to be from a relatively rural place. And you know, I said, think about how ubiquitous technology has become in agriculture. I said, think about all the data that has to go back and forth, even these days from the local family farm to, you know, to partners and suppliers and vendors and all those types of things. And his eyes lit up and he's like, oh, I didn't really think about it that way. And so, you know, I think certainly computing is a very lucrative career, no matter whether you want to go work for a technology company or, frankly, you want to go work in another industry. There are certainly, I think, a wide variety of recognized credentials that exist today in the computing field. We certainly see a number of not only company-specific but sometimes association-generated credentials that are meaningful. Certainly Microsoft has its own slew of credentials, whether, you know, we're talking about folks that are in the IT deployment side or whether they're on the engineering side or whether they're on the networking side. And we've spent quite a bit of time in thinking about how we recognize those that have really great computing skills, no matter how those get defined. or no matter how those get used in the in their professional lives. And so for kids that are interested in computer science, there's certainly a number of career options. If they're for kids that are interested in the IT pro side of the world, there are certainly a number of options and a number of credentials that support that. I don't know that I have an opinion, you know, around the notion of ethics and personal responsibility and those types of things. I do know that, you know, when we as a company think about the way that we think of our role not only in the industry but in the business world and frankly in our local communities, it's something that we take very seriously. And Microsoft has a long history of looking at how we not only support responsible computing and safe computing, and we've done a tremendous amount of work in that space over the last 15 or 20 years, whether that is helping kids learn how to stay safe online or helping their parents understand how to keep them safe online, or whether it's overhauling our software development practices to make sure that security and privacy are at the forefront of our own development cycles, or working with our partners to do so. Those are all things that we think are critically important. And we extend that, you know, well beyond the work that we do inside the company to the work that we do outside the company with our partners. And we continue to make that very real in the commitment that Microsoft has to citizenship and philanthropy, you know, in the communities in which we work. We all feel inside the company very privileged to work for the company, and we feel very privileged to be able to represent the technology industry through the work that we do wherever it is that we work, and we want to make sure that, you know, all of our employees not only embrace that, but certainly live that on a daily basis so that we are seen not only as a good corporate citizen, but actually as a valuable member of the communities in which we have the privilege to do business.
Well, Lauren, again, thank you for coming in today. You know, we're just very privileged to have you take the time to share your thoughts and deep insights. You are a global technology policy authority and just a tremendous background. So, again, thank you for coming in and sharing your experiences with our audience.
Thank you for having me. The privilege has been all mine.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Lauren Woodman, Microsoft General Manager, Education Programs, and top global technology policy authority.